listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, we've talked about the media a lot on this program. It's ups, it's downs, it's sideways. The media's relationship to war, though, is something that I don't think ever gets anywhere near enough coverage, particularly this aggregated, agopolistic, semi-monopolistic corporate media that we have. Peter Hart is the activism director with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, FAIR, and the co-producer of Counterspin, the website fair.org, and he just authored a piece that's over on Huffington Post. Peter, welcome to the program.
It's my pleasure.
Glad to have you with us. Actually, did you write this piece or did Michael Calderon?
At Huffington Post, that was Michael.
That was Michael.
It was based on the piece that I wrote for
Fair. Based on the piece you wrote for Fair. So tell us the situation. What did you guys learn?
Well, the interesting thing in watching the debate about going back to war in Iraq and dropping bombs in Syria, probably put debate in quotes, was how little debate there was. One of the most interesting things that kind of went viral was when the former press secretary, Jay Carney, and John McCain got into it on CNN on the night of Obama's speech to the nation, sort of laying out his strategy. And the thing that was so striking about it was that these are two guys that could get into a very heated-looking argument on television, but on, you know, in practical terms, what did they disagree about? They both supported war. McCain, unsurprisingly to, I'm sure, every single one of your listeners, wanted a more forceful, more aggressive form of war than Carney and the White House did. But that was, I think, indicative of the kind of debate that was happening across the media landscape, not whether or not we should go to war, not what war could do to people in those countries, not whether it could achieve the goals as set out by the White House, but whether or not we should have this much war or this much war. That was the debate. So we looked at a bunch of the main debate discussion shows, the Sunday shows, a couple of the cable news shows, the PBS NewsHour, looking at who was invited to these debate segments or one-on-one interviews to try to get a sense of who is being asked to weigh in on this and what kind of discussion are we really having.
And you learned?
Overwhelmingly, we heard from people who, unsurprisingly, supported the war. We found 205 guests across these shows. 125 of them supported going to war. 6 were opposed to the wars in Iraq or Syria. On the Sunday shows, which are kind of a good indicator for what elite debate is thinking about a particular subject, 89 in favor of going to war, 1 lonely voice opposed to the wars in Iraq and Syria. Government officials were almost 40% of the guests. Journalists were over that. So you had this elite debate among people about the type of war that we should be waging, not whether or not we should go to war in the first place. And I think it speaks volumes about where the two parties are on this and, of course, where the media are.
Well, there's plenty of anti-war voices, at least within the Democratic Party. I mean, virtually the entire Progressive Caucus, correct me if I'm wrong, the largest caucus in the House, generally is opposed to war. Was this a self-selection process on the part of the media?
I think that's some of it. You know, when an administration has to roll out a policy like this, you'll see, you know, their spokespeople across the show. So you see Samantha Power, you know, doing one of those Sundays where she shows up on every program. John Kerry was doing a similar kind of effort. So you're going to have a lot of pro-war sentiment. I think the problem with this discussion is that it got bogged down in kind of the details about when and how Congress should weigh in on military authorization in Syria or Iraq. You had people on the right, people like Peter King, congressman from New York, saying, you know, Obama has this authority anyway. We don't really need to weigh in. So, you know, to the extent that there was criticism of the White House, it mostly came from the right, from people who said this strategy makes no sense. It needs to be much more aggressive. We need to drop more bombs on these countries until the Islamic State gets the message. That was the voice of skepticism in this discussion that we were having. So it was a little bit different from the Iraq War, the run-up in 2002 and 2003, where everyone just sort of bought the administration's line.
Except for the few people who got thrown off the air. Bill Maher.
Exactly.
You know, Phil Donahue.
Yeah, and you saw these little pockets of skepticism, and those were quickly shut down. In this case, we had the appearance of debate in the sense that you would sometimes have Democrats on who said the Obama strategy it makes sense, and then you had Republicans on saying, no, it needs to be much more aggressive. But that's not a debate over war. That's a debate over how much war.
Right. Why do you think this is?
I think there isn't a coherent anti-war voice in one of the major parties. So, you know, to the extent that these shows reflect the debate that's happening between Democrats and Republicans, they perfectly captured the view, I think, of the elites in both parties. You would think a media system that lived through the debacle of the Iraq War would understand that a debate has to be much broader than that. You know, you mentioned the Progressive Caucus, and of course there are members of the Progressive Caucus, but then you can go outside that. There are all kinds of people you could talk to about this. If you wanted to have a discussion, you could, God forbid, talk to anti-war activists about whether or not we should go to war. But that's an idea that just simply is not.
Yeah. Or even some very, I mean, there's some very thoughtful people out there who have been in the middle of these kind of policy debates forever. Tom Hayden comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, you know, who, I mean, he's a former state senator. He's got credibility. I don't see those voices. I don't hear those
voices.
No, and,
you know, Andrew Basevich from Boston University, who does a lot of interviews, and he was on the PBS NewsHour. This is somebody who's studied war. He's a former military official himself, and said, you know, if the strategy doesn't make sense and the goals don't line up with what you say you're going to do, then there's no reason to think this is going to work, and there's no reason to think that it's wise. So you did have people, I think, who have a certain kind of credibility in the eyes of the military establishment, perhaps, who could speak forcefully about this. But I think one thing that made this debate similar to the Iraq debate was the idea that the parties have generally signed on in one form or another. So you had people, you had Democrats saying, you know, I support bombing Iraq, but maybe not Syria. You had Republicans saying we should do both. There wasn't a sense that elites were opposed on this. And once you have that dynamic at the top, it's very difficult for corporate media to present any other kind of debate, even though the debate that should happen is, of course, much more nuanced and, I think, more substantive than that. But
do you think we'd be having a different debate if we had a national draft?
If we had a what?
A draft.
I suspect it would affect the way some politicians spoke about it. You know, you have had a couple of politicians who have, people like Charlie Rangel, have talked about this
right.
as a means to engineer a different kind of debate. And I think there's probably something to that. If not in the media, then in the public at large, if
right.
people felt like there was some skin in the game.
Peter, we have a little less than a minute left. What can we do about this?
To the extent that people can raise their voices about this and make it make elites in the media or in politics understand that there is some opposition to these plans, then I think that's the first step. And the second step is to seek out a media that's going to tell you a different kind of story than the Sunday shows.
Well, that opposition was fairly aggressive when the president was talking about going into Syria, and it seems like it influenced him. Am I missing something?
Oh, yeah. You know, a year ago, sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was one of the most unusual moments in, you know, foreign policy media discussions, in the sense that opposition to the president's, any president, whether it's Obama or anyone, opposition to the president's drive for war seemed to be very loud, very very thoughtful, and very well represented
but
in the press.
Yeah.
And we saw that have a real effect.
Yeah, there you go. Peter Hart, the activism director with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, FAIR. FAIR.org is the website, also the co-producer of Counterspin. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
How do you think we can most effectively have reasonable, rational conversations about the mass insanity that is war? And welcome back. Joe, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Jasper, Georgia. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing this morning? I need to talk to somebody who's got some sense, so I had to call you.
Okay.
Well, I've been calling around trying to find some of these climate scientists to talk to answer some questions for me. And I got a volcanologist, he tells me one thing. I got a botanist, he tells me another. The volcanologist tells me Mid-Atlantic Ridge is rising, causing ocean levels to rise. The botanist says there ain't no CO2 problem. And my machines aren't picking it up. I'm a Georgia Clean Air inspector, and I'm certified in drivability, OBD2 inspection. I've been doing this stuff for 30 years. I did it before it was cool. And they won't answer my question. I can't find this elusive CO2. It's heavier than air gas, and we know that. And they call us the elite of the elite, the Georgia Clean Air Force, when they put us together.
Joe, you're not making any sense to me at all. Are you trying to tell me that there's no shortage of measurements indicating that the oceans have warmed, and warm air is
I know the Mid-Atlantic Ridge is coming
occupies
up.
More space than cold air does, or more cold water does. Number one, number two, you've got glaciers melting
100,000 volcanic 20,000 to 100,000 volcanic vents in the Mid-Atlantic Plains, at least running hydrothermal vents 3,000 degrees or better apiece. Don't you think they'll boil a little water? Couple of degrees.
No, I think that's been going on for 3-4 billion years.
Who is some scientist you would give me a name and number to that would set me straight?
I would suggest that you look up the IPCC studies. They have a website. You can easily find it.
I've cleaned the air up more by hand every day, 6 days a week, than all these scientists weigh all together.
I beg your pardon?
I have cleaned up more air. I do it every day. That's what I do. I make cars pass emissions. And
right.
I've cleaned up more of the environment than all these scientists weigh.
Well, the scientist's job is not to fine-tune cars so that they have lower emissions. Their job is to measure
To make CO2. They tell us to make CO2. Take HCCO and everything and run it through the cat and make H2O, CO, and...
Yeah, the catalytic converters are doing is they're reducing high fraction hydrocarbons, which are cancer causing, down to carbon dioxide. But you know, the ultimate solution is not to use any hydrocarbons at all, not to use fossil fuels.
Yeah, but if it comes out H2O water and it comes out nitrogen, which is a normal element, and it comes out the CO2. CO2 is 1.5 times heavier than air. It hovers near the ground. I'm finding levels of 13% to 75%. And I'm mobilized. I've got 6 machines. I've got 3 shops. And I've got we're in school every 4 months to do drivability for new cars, everything. We're updated all the time. We put in facts to them. We're the pathfinders. And these scientists, like that scientist, he told me there was global warming. Then I talked to him. After he talked to me for a minute, he told me about the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. When you single them out, they act like they never said that.
Joe, you need a little larger scientific base than the CO2 you're measuring around the car shop where you're fixing catalytic converters. That is not going to inform you and about what's going on. Joe, thanks for the call. thanks. We'll be back. Oh, my goodness. Al Franken apparently has schooled. Who was that? Ted Cruz. Who was that idiot? Ted Cruz is like, the internet is, net neutrality is Obamacare for the internet. I've had 3 now. Count them. 3 right-wingers. One called into my show. 2 were on the TV show last week. Exactly use that line. You know, so clearly, Frank Luntz has, or somebody like him has, focus grouped this bumper sticker. Net neutrality is like Obamacare for the internet. There is no relationship between the two. As Al Franken pointed out, Obamacare changed things. It allowed 50, 60 million people who don't have insurance to get insurance. It prevented the insurance company from screwing us, companies from screwing us, from saying, oh, you've got a pre-existing condition. Oh, you got sick. We're going to do something called rescission. We're going to dump you. It provided people with free health insurance, Medicaid, if they're low income enough, or discounts on Obamacare subsidies. if they're, you know, middle, low income. That's what Obamacare did. Net neutrality simply keeps the internet the way it is, neutral. And Al Franken pointed out there was three guys in the back of a pizza shop. Now, Google had already rolled out a video product, and they were fixing to dominate the video market. They had already rolled this thing out. And these three guys in the back of a pizza shop came up with a better product and ate Google's lunch. This better product was called YouTube. It was three guys in a pizza shop. And it was so good that Google ultimately paid $1.6 billion to buy it. That innovation would not have been possible if Ted Cruz, this idiot boy child, if Ted Cruz had his way. Net neutrality is very, very simple. It's just like telephone neutrality. The phone company can't listen in on your phone conversations and, as a consequence of what you say or who you're talking to, charge you a different price or give you a different quality connection. Hey, you know, Shano there is having a conversation with his brother. Well, that's just personal stuff. Let's cut his bandwidth down to 1 kilohertz. It'll sound scratchy and obnoxious, but at least they can hear each other. Or he's talking to his brother. Yeah, it's family. We'll charge him 3 cents a minute. But when he's talking to Tom, hey, that's business. We're going to charge him 20 cents a minute. And have a whole army of people or a whole bunch of, you know, robots, computers, which is how they do it with the internet, listening to everything you say or every place you call. You call a place of business. Hey, that's a business call. That's an extra 50 cents. Every place you call and charge you based on that. That is what the cable companies want to do to the internet. And net neutrality prevents them from doing that, which is why Comcast is fighting Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, and all of their Republican shills and a few Democratic shills. All the people, all the politicians that Citizens United has allowed these big corporations to buy are out there like Ted Cruz going, oh, it's Obamacare for the internet. No, sorry. It's not. Net neutrality means that the internet works the same way the phone company does, which is they can't pay attention. They can't listen in on, or in this case, watch what websites you're going to and then adjust your bill based on that. Now, just like with the telephone, if you use 5,000 minutes of phone, you might end up spending $200 a month. If you only use 500 minutes of phone, you might only end up spending, you know, $30. Usage can be metered. I mean, that's how it works with phones. That's how it works with the internet right now. That's how it would work with the internet under net neutrality. And similarly with the phone, if you want to make a long distance call, if you want to call somebody in Burkina Faso or Germany or South Africa or Beijing, it's going to cost you more than if you want to call somebody in Philadelphia. Well, similarly with the internet, if you want to be able to download large quantities of data at very fast speeds, your internet company can charge you more money for that with net neutrality. What they can't do is look at what it is you're downloading. What they can't do is say, oh, look at that. He's downloading House of Cards. I guess we'll charge him an extra 20 cents a minute. Oh, look at that. He's downloading porn. I guess we'll charge him an extra $3 a minute. They can't do that. Just like your phone company can't listen in on your phone conversation to Beijing or Burkina Faso or wherever it is and say, oh, look at that. He's not only having a long distance call. This would be in internet parlance, a high volume of traffic or data. But it's about this topic. So we're going to charge him. Can't do that. So, A, how do we get through to our media that, you know, especially those of us who think that war is organized mass murder and organized insanity, how do we get some balance in our media? And B, how do we get through to these idiots like Ted Cruz? I mean, Ted Cruz is either deeply intellectually challenged. I don't mean that as a joke. He is either dumber than dog do, or he is a really good liar. I'm inclined to think the latter.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But obviously, it's not just Ted Cruz. It's, you know, the whole bunch of them that are out there spouting the lines of the big corporations who will cross their palms and find cash. Eight minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you in the place where smart people get their news, and Glenn in Venice, Florida. Hey, Glenn, welcome to the program.
Peace and blessings to you and your family, sir.
Thank you, and to you, too.
Thank you. I was calling reference to the discussion as how we should discuss, quote, war, unquote.
Right.
And I think if we talked about it in terms of peace and diffusing situations, that would start the conversation in a different direction. As soon as you say, let's discuss war, mm-hmm. it's like, well, peace isn't an option.
Right. That's interesting. This was the inspiration behind Marianne Williamson and Dennis Kucinich starting the Department of Peace, or proposing a Department of Peace, so that there would be a cabinet-level officer sitting, or a cabinet-level person sitting in the cabinet room with the president whenever there was a consequential meeting, whose sole job was to advocate for peace, as opposed to the quote Defense Department or the War Department advocating for war. I think you're right.
Yeah, and if he were, and if this individual, he or she were part of the cabinet, then maybe they might get a seat on Meet the Press once in the blue moon.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. There you go, Glenn. Thanks a lot for the call. Well said, Jeffrey in Kissimmee, Florida. Hey, Jeffrey, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, I'm surprised that nobody mentioned this, but I think it's pretty obvious why there's no anti-war position represented on the Sunday shows. If you watch these shows, if you watch the commercials, you see Boeing, you see Lockheed Martin, and they're not selling airplanes, they're buying influence.
Right.
They're defense contractors.
Right.
And they control the message on the show, because if they don't like what they're saying, they pull their advertising, and the show loses a ton of revenue.
You're absolutely right. And
influence over the discussion.
Yeah, and those ads are not there because they're hoping that you or I, as the viewer, will say, gee, I don't own an F-35, and I've got enough room in my backyard. I really ought to buy one. Instead, those ads are there to influence public opinion, to influence legislators, but most importantly, to influence the network itself. Here is, you know, $60 million this year for advertising for our F-35s or whatever it may be, and please treat us well, basically, is the subtext of that message. Yeah. I think you got it, Jeffrey. And I see the same thing, by the way, with the oil and natural gas and coal ads. This is their way of saying don't cover global warming, don't cover the anti-coal activists, don't do documentaries on mountaintop removal, don't show real pictures of what the tar sands look like up in Alberta, et cetera. This is the old Lee Atwater, let's work the refs strategy, and it's working, I think, brilliantly. Jeffrey, thank you. This is one of the great vulnerabilities of for-profit news, and one of the reasons why back before 1987, in most news organizations, as the experience that I had back from 1968 to 1978, working in news, well, actually from 71 to 78, working in news, I was a DJ before that, in Lansing, Michigan, was that if, as a news person, I was caught talking to the salespeople in our radios, in the radio stations that I worked for, and most of that time was in one radio station, I would be fired. And that salesperson could be fired, because sales and news were not supposed to talk. Joey in Lake Elsinore, California. Hey, Joey, welcome to the program.
Go.
The world would be a better place if we stopped using cars and burning gasoline and started using solar panel cars. The solar panel car takes in solar energy, and with a press of a button, it takes in lunar energy. Do you know why it's so hot here? Gases polluting the air. Solar panel cars don't pollute. It takes in and gives out cool air and oxygen. It's about 50. Will be 71 degrees in 30 days. If you pay $2 more, we will install my green electric formula that will also take in lunar energy. The car will only cost you $155, I guarantee it. What would we get if we stopped using gasoline? It would reduce the risk of explosions. It would stop burning dinosaur bones, and it will reduce the risk of global warming. It may even solve why volcanoes erupt. The plates on the Earth move while the heat from the sun is heating up the lava. It makes even deadlier. It makes it even deadlier. We wouldn't have to pay our car bills, too. What we would get if we used the solar panel car? It would put jobs into business, and it will also reduce noise. It
right.
will reduce the air pollution. It will make a big difference in the weather. It will have a wind-powered engine, and it will change the world. It will change air into cool oxygen. In a few days, it will reduce the heat by 2% a day. If you help, it will change the world a lot.
Yeah. Joey, brilliant. How old are you?
I'm only 10. I'm in fourth grade.
Wow. Did you write that, or did your parents, or was it a collaborative effort?
I actually found it. I typed this up for my project on the reflections on the world would be a better place if.
Wow. That's great. Joey, congratulations. Thank you. And thank you for watching us in Lake Elsinore, California. And thanks for coming on and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck. a budding scientist here or politician or something. I don't know. Joey's going to go a long way, I guarantee you. Charles in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Charles.
Hey, you had asked the question, what can we do to push back from war?
Mm-hmm.
The only thing you can do is vote. Everything else is just talk. I mean, you can go out there and, you know, you can protest, but there is no there's really only two things in our society that get changed, and that's economic boycotts because, you know, whether that you agree they work or not, that's an option because, you know, corporations, they're based on money. If they don't make money, they'll make changes. And voting. Voting is puts the politicians want to be in office to make decisions.
Right.
Everything else, Occupy Wall Street, I mean, they don't respect that. I mean, you have to – during – you're of that age – during the 1970s, when they wanted to lower the voting age to 18, the people of that era turned out. And at that point, you know, they got rid of a draft. So, yeah. And number two, there was a show on last week on public television called The Green Berets, The Untold Story. I don't know if anybody saw that.
I did not see
But it was basically, yeah, there was a show that talked about the Green Berets and the history and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it was pretty good. They talked about the history. Funny thing, they only mentioned two Democrats, Democratic presidents through that entire show. And, of course, they had to talk about Truman because that was about the time when it was created. And then they mentioned Kennedy. Mm-hmm. They didn't mention, you know, any other Democratic president.
Wow.
They mentioned every single Republican president. And it's obvious that, you know, this is some sort of, you know, slanted partisan show. The show had a pretty good show, pretty good representation of the Green Berets. But it was just so slanted, you know, politically. You know, it seems like the entire, you know, starting to smear the Democrats and the president. It's starting to begin right now, you know, as far as the media and PBS and
yeah.
the donations at the
which program. Charles, that's an example of how, you know, I don't disagree with you. The voting's really important. But that said, you have one vote. I have one vote. But if you and I can each influence 10 people. We can have some say in 22 votes between the two of us. And that's what that documentary is doing, is it's trying to influence people in favor of Republicans and away from Democrats. And that's something that you and I could be doing. We could do it by joining groups like MoveOn.org or MoveToAmend.org or ColorOfChange.org. I mean, there's all these great organizations that are politically active that change people's minds and affect the vote. So I think that I'd like to respectfully add number three to your list that mm-hmm. in addition to voting and in addition to, you know, economically behaving in a way that reflects our values, that we also need to be waking other people up.
I agree. Can I make one quick point?
Yeah, go for it.
Yes. The reality is that, yes, I can influence the past election here. I'm in DeKalb County.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in Stone Mountain area.
Yeah.
Supposedly the, you know, the second wealthiest majority black county in the United States, blah, 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 blah. People didn't turn out. You know, you can influence everybody, but if you do not vote, if you do not make those numbers higher than the next person, then nothing's going to happen. I mean, I can influence all I want. I can't lead the person into the voting booth.
Well, that's part of your influencing, is influencing people to vote.
I go out there and I canvass. I'm involved locally. As a matter of fact, I go out there and young people I see, at the local community area center I live by here. I try to get them involved. I engage them in the streets. I mean, you know, people are not voting. I mean, you know, people can complain and whatever. I mean, you know, school systems used to teach this in high school, civics and the basics.
Right.
A lot of these kids, they don't even understand, though. They don't understand. They can't name the three branches of the government. They don't even know anything about how. My nephew, who's 12 years old, goes to a charter school, and they teach him that stuff. But the public schools around here, the kids have no idea. Seniors, they graduate, don't even know that. When I was going to school in Ohio in the late 70s, one of my things was you graduated, you had to go out there and you had to register to vote.
Because
that was part of our 12th grade civics, what do you call it, civics back then.
Yeah, there are only 9 states now that require civics in order to graduate from high school. This is a crime.
I originally went originally from Connecticut, which had one of the top schools in the public schools in the country in the 60s and 70s, to Ohio.
Right.
But even Cincinnati suburbs had better schools than they do now. So I'm saying my point I'm trying to make is that 30% voting turnout last November, the Tuesday. I mean,
last
people
week,
can complain.
Yeah.
People can talk about this, the other. You're not going to get the people in office. You know, if you don't vote, people say you're going to punish the Democrats. Well, you're rewarding the Republicans.
Yep, you're right. Charles, very well said. Thank you very much. Thanks for your activism, and thanks for, you know, keeping on with it. I appreciate the call. It's 15 minutes.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More of the news of the day, my thoughts on it, and your thoughts on my thoughts right after this. Welcome back. Dwayne in Pelion, South Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Dwayne, what's up? Dwayne, you are on the air. No, Dwayne is not on the air. Donna in Plano,
Donna,
Texas. Hey, Donna, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Watch it every day. My problem is Rick Perry. He did not take the federal
Medicaid expansion money.
That, and he did not. We only have 4 insurance companies for medical.
Oh, and you're in your Obamacare exchange, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so. My husband and I, $1,400 a month, who can afford that?
Not a lot of people.
Not a lot of people. We can't afford it anymore. I just got a letter on Friday saying that they were raising it 22%. So now it's going to be $1,750 per month. Just for our, whatever you call it.
Health insurance, yeah. Have you gone on to ACA website?
I've tried.
Because a lot of, you know, there's new companies coming into the mix. There are several states where rates are going down. There are other states where rates are going up. You know, things are.
Texas sucks.
Yeah, I would imagine, but Texas is a large market. There have to be insurers who are interested. Donna, when you've looked around at what your other options are, I know a lot of people are going to be changing plans this year because their old plans are going to charge more. But on the other hand, there's a lot of nonprofits who are starting to get into this business as well, and they're offering, you know, really good prices.
I hope so.
Yeah. So I wish
we just can't find anything that is. I mean, $1,700 a month.
Yeah.
For my husband and I.
Well, depending on what your income is, you may qualify for some substantial subsidies for that.
No, we don't.
Yeah.
He's over the limit.
Yeah, so you're making more than $70,000 a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean.
Well, if you're making more than $70,000 a year, you know, I don't mean to sound glib, but $1,400 a month, that would be a little less than $2,000 a year.
No, $1,700.
I beg your pardon?
No, as of January 1st, it will be $1,700.
Right.
$1,700.
Right.
Who can afford that? That's
So
someone's house.
Yeah, that's roughly $20,000 a year. That is a lot of money. Yep. Donna, I wish you well. Good luck. This is, you know, what you're pointing out is why we need to have a public option in the ACA if we're going to continue doing it this way and let Medicare compete with all these for-profit insurance companies. Corky in Rochester. Oh, only 2 seconds? Let me put Corky on hold. Sorry, I missed that break there for that cue. We'll be right back. It is 10 minutes before you go. Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, and John in San Diego, you say that I am attacking your views and you want to defend them. What's that mean?
Well, I just wanted to defend some of the grassroots libertarians out there. Seems like the way you characterize us is buying into, you know, big business and set them all free and, you know, screw the little guy. But I think that where I'm coming from is that I used to be a Democrat, and I think that with the realization of just how bad it is, it really kind of wakes you up to the fact that the Democrats and the Republicans seem to be working on the same page. They have
no, they're not, John. They're actually not. There are some very, very large differences. The Republicans want to, in a libertarian way, take Social Security and hand it over to Wall Street. The Democrats don't. The Republicans want to give people vouchers for Medicaid and Medicare so that they have to buy it from for-profit insurance companies. The Democrats don't. They want it run by the government where there's only a 2 or 3% overhead. The Republicans want to deregulate air pollution from the Koch brothers refineries. The Democrats don't. They want to keep that air clean. The Republicans want to deregulate the water pollution from the Koch brothers paper factories from Georgia-Pacific. The Democrats don't. I mean, I could do through this all day long. There are huge differences between the parties. But the difference between the parties or lack of differences between the parties doesn't justify the naivete of most libertarians. Can you identify for me, outside of Somalia, any country in the world that has been run along libertarian lines? And I don't think you'd want to live in Somalia and has had any success whatsoever. Any time in the history of the world.
I would say that the best example was, you know, old America, but it really hasn't gotten a chance because...
Which old America?
It never really has come to complete, you know...
No, libertarian has never been tried, John, because it doesn't work.
Well, how about this? Okay, you got the Republicans and the Democrats that both work hand-in-hand and pass stuff like the Patriot Act. And these wars continue, and it just seems like an arguing match.
John, if the libertarians had absolute power, they would love the Patriot Act because it hands more power over to big corporations and takes it away from.
Barack Obama has a power to take the Patriot Act away. Or make, you know, bully pulpit. Make
yeah, John, you're changing the subject. The Patriot Act and libertarianism. Libertarianism is
the things that they work on. You want to point out the differences, and I would say these are you know, lower level issues that we're allowed to talk about and banter, but we're never allowed to address the true issues. Like, for example, 9/11 being a complete inside job, and both parties cooperating with not talking about it. Number two.
Wait a second. What is libertarian? So as a libertarian, you believe that 9/11 was done by the government, George Bush, I assume?
Well, parts of the government cooperating with big business, cooperating with other governments.
So wouldn't it get worse if you totally freed big business from any government oversight whatsoever?
No, that's not what
well, war is very profitable. It seems to me like if the corporations are capable of helping attack America, they would be doing it on a more regular basis, so that we would be throwing more money at them to build larger armies to, quote, protect us.
Well, why don't you get guests on that expose the smoking gun, the multiple smoking guns of 9/11, such as Richard Gage of 9/11, architects and engineers for 9/11.
We've had them on the program. We've had David Ray Griffin on the program. Libertarianism at its core is an economic policy and economic and political policy.
The second big issue is the Federal Reserve.
What does libertarianism have to do with the Federal Reserve?
Well, I would say that both the Democrats and the Republicans and the purchased mainstream media all cooperate into not discussing where our money comes from, the fundamental facts of the way that our banking system works.
What's your alternative, John, to the Fed?
Well, we need to educate the public.
What's your alternative to the Fed?
Well, actually, there's the author of the Money Masters, or the maker of that. He's been studying currency for like 30 years, and there's two different ways of thought. We have gold-backed currency, and I know you don't like that, and there are limitations, and all the bad guys have got all the gold right now. Duly noted. But the second option is for a fiat currency. And that's
what we have
now. But what we have now is a private ownership of that fiat currency.
Yeah, well, John, I don't disagree that the Fed should be owned by the Treasury Department.
It's fundamental for everything. If we're all competing with units of Federal Reserve notes as our competitive edge.
But, John, you are arguing against libertarianism. Libertarianism says government should not do things, private corporations should do things. You're arguing...
Well, it's a pendulum.
No.
Because it's nothing's absolute. Because right now we've got, the IRS, seasonal ladies' bank accounts with no charges. We got asset seizures on the freeway. We've got a private for-profit prison industry. We've got a war machine that you admit is going out of control. And
these are all driven by libertarian policies.
No.
It is libertarian policies, John, that say that government should not be taking tax dollars from rich people. Instead, it should be building its police departments and running them by seizing money from criminals. It is libertarian policy.
Should government be taking money to make elaborate hoaxes on us, to lie to us, to nudge us into certain... mindset, so we're more likely to be cooperative.
Yeah, John, you're not. I don't think you understand respectfully libertarian policy, and it sounds like you just watched what's that movie Zeitgeist, and are developing a theology around that. Libertarianism is basically getting rid of government and replacing it with billionaires, and it doesn't work.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And ecowine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at tomhartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we mentioned net neutrality in the last hour. Harold Furchgott-Roth is on the line with us, the former commissioner of the FCC, a senior fellow now with the Hudson Institute and president of Furchgott-Roth Economic Enterprises, FURCHGOTT-ROTH.com is the website, and there'll be a link to it off TomHartmann.com if you weren't scribbling really fast when I told you that. And Harold, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. I don't understand why anybody would be opposed to designating the internet under Title II of the Telecommunications Act as a public utility. Why would anybody want Comcast to have the right to monitor every little bit of activity that I am doing on the internet or you are doing on the internet and then bill us based on the sites that we go to? Why is that a good thing, other than that it makes more money for Comcast?
Well, before one gets to the question of whether Title II is a good policy or not, there's a threshold issue of whether it's legal or not. And the Federal Communications Commission has been in court not once but twice in the past 4 years trying to promulgate network neutrality rules, and it's lost both times.
But they haven't invoked Title II. And prior to 2002, in the Bush administration, when Michael Powell went in, you know, for the first 20 years of its existence, the internet was operating under Title II of the Telecommunications
Act. Tom, I'm afraid that's just not accurate. The internet was not operating under Title II before 2002.
It was effectively. I mean, the effect was the same, was it not?
No. In the 1990s, during the Clinton administration, Vice President Gore and politicians of all stripes were quite adamant that the internet was not to be regulated. There were two consistent bipartisan themes about the internet: don't tax the internet and don't regulate the internet. Okay. The internet was not regulated under Title II. There was one small part of it that might have been, which was what was then called line sharing of copper lines. But that's not was not a large part of the internet at the time, and it certainly is a very, very tiny part of the internet today.
So what? Yeah, you know, I read your op-ed in which you were suggesting that over in Forbes that the president is attacking the FCC's independence. I don't, other than it being an attack on Obama, I get that. You don't apparently like him, but I don't see what this has to do with keeping an internet that is basically not being, that is a public utility, that's not being run for, you know, people can make money on it, but it's not being run specifically for the benefit of Comcast and Verizon. It's being run for the benefit of we the people. It's part of our information commons. How do we do that?
Well, the column you referenced was about President Obama's statement last Monday, in which he just cut the legs out from under his own chairman of the FCC. Frankly, also the other four commissioners. There's no precedent for the President of the United States going public and saying, this is what you all are going to do. Now, of course, there is this caveat. He sort of says, well, of course, you're independent. You can do whatever you want to do, but I'm telling you, this is what you're going to do.
He didn't say that. He said, this is what you should do. And that's his job. I mean, he's the head of the executive division of the three branches of government. And the FCC is part of that. He can't specifically tell them what to do, but he can certainly tell them what he thinks they should do. Isn't that his job?
For the past 80 years, there have been many presidents of all parties. There have been members of Congress of all different parties. And they've treated independent agencies with a certain degree of neutrality, if you will, of not going public and sort of saying this is what you should do, if you will. The independent agencies have react very negatively when they hear politicians publicly sort of telling them what to
what if he's right?
Be doing. And he could have done this in a much more conventional way, which is he could have submitted this in writing. He could have done this in the way that presidents have done for 80 years. There's no precedent for the president of the United States going public with a video in the way that President Obama did last week. And
good
Tom
on him.
Wheeler, the chairman of the FCC, is not a happy camper.
No, no, I get that. The chairman of the FCC used to be the head lobbyist for the telecom industry. You know, of course he's not a happy camper. You know, and there's this huge revolving door. I mean, Michael Powell, the previous head of the FCC, is now has the job that Wheeler used to have. He's the head of the biggest lobbyist in the industry. That doesn't mean that we should all just roll over and say, okay, you know, my ISP. You know, we are the fools of the world, Harold. You know, in Japan and China and South Korea and Germany, I've been in all these places. I've used internet around the world. They're paying anywhere from a fifth to a tenth of what we're paying. They're getting 2, 3, 5, 10 times the speed we're getting. And in most of these countries, you know, just because you own the copper doesn't mean that you're the sole source ISP. In other words, they have to rent it to other ISPs, which means that there's competition in the marketplace. I mean, the president didn't even go as far as to recommend that.
Tom, I don't know where you've been, but there are international comparisons that are prepared by various groups all the time. There's a recent one that's come out by Akamai. The speeds that are available in the United States are among the fastest in the world. There's no difference in the type of technology that's available. There are differences in the uptake rates, and it is true that our prices tend to be higher than in a lot of other parts of the world. But that's in part because we tax the internet. We have a lot of charges on it that probably shouldn't be there. We also don't subsidize the internet in the same way that some of the other countries you mentioned do. So it simply isn't the case that there is some magic technology that's out there that has higher speeds and somehow that American companies aren't deploying it.
Then why is it that Chattanooga, Tennessee, which has a municipal broadband, municipal internet system, has some of the best and lowest cost internet in the United States? And then on the other hand, you've got the American Legislative Exchange Council, you know, John Kasich and Paul Weyrich's old organization, that has proposed model legislation that's been picked up by 19 states, forbidding communities from doing what Chattanooga has done, from making the internet a public utility. Isn't the internet the library of today? Or is it just another profit source?
Well, first of all, the city of Chattanooga does have a wonderful system, but it is this is a taxpayer-subsidized system,
right,
if you will, in the sense that they don't pay taxes to the government in the same way that private companies would. And the issue with Chattanooga is not whether Chattanooga should offer a service or not. I haven't heard that. I think the issue is whether the federal government should preempt the state government of Tennessee and forbid Chattanooga from...
No, there's 19 states where what Chattanooga has done is illegal.
Oh, yes, and that's been the case for a very long time.
And it's wrong.
That's not new. Well, then that's an issue for the state legislators in those states to come to grips with. Every state is a little different, and they each have different views of what their municipality should or should not be doing.
Harold Furchtgott-Roth, former FCC commissioner, senior fellow with the Hudson Institute, president of Furchtgott-Roth Economic Enterprises, FURCHGOTT-ROTH.com is the website. Harold, thank you for dropping by today.
Anytime.
Or Commissioner Furchtgott-Roth, I should call you correctly. Thank you for dropping by. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm not sure if that was heat or light or neither, but we'll be back for your conversations. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Corky in Rochester, New York, watching Free Speech TV. Let's try it again, Corky. What's up?
Yeah, you were talking about the war.
Yeah.
War is nothing more than a business. And our young children are the workers in that business. They're the ones that go fight the wars. But war is a business. It's for profit.
Right.
You know, and wherever they can come up with a reason to send our troops in, then you got money coming and throwing in, you know, hand over fist.
Right.
You got tanks. There should be no military lobbyists in Washington. We got generals, admirals, and whatnot who tell us what they need to keep the country safe. It should be illegal for anybody to lobby for military supplies.
Yeah.
It should be for the generals and the admirals. Tell us what they need. They get what they need to protect us.
Well, and it was before World War II. I mean, that was the whole point of Eisenhower's, and you need to turn your TV down, Corky, or it's going to make both of us crazy. But that was the whole point of Eisenhower's farewell speech, was that prior to World War II, we had some small industries in the United States that made things like guns and bullets. But basically, there was not, and you know, on a small basis, tanks and aircraft. But we had converted the domestic industry of manufacturing cars. We turned that into manufacturing planes and tanks. We took the domestic industry of making mostly nylon stockings for women and turned that into making parachutes. We took the domestic industry of making blue jeans and shirts and turned that into uniforms. We took the domestic industry of making shoes and turned that into making, you know, combat boots. We, as Eisenhower said, you know, we turned our plowshare industry into a weapon of war industry. And now, after World War II, a lot of those industries are not going back to making plowshares. They're going to continue making weapons of war. And this, as he said, this is an entirely new thing in the United States. And it is so large now, and it is so all-consuming. You know, you're not going to get rid of it. I don't have an easy
point.
Go ahead.
That's my point. When you have a business, you have to keep customers coming in the door to keep your business rolling.
Right, which is why these guys advocate for war, and it's why it makes me crazy when I watch, you know, the television and I see some general on there talking about, you know, what's going on anywhere in the world, and that general is not being disclosed. That general's on the board of half a dozen different defense corporations, and each one of those board positions pays them a couple hundred grand a year or more. And so here's somebody getting rich off war, and they're on TV telling us all about the wonders of war.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. We got to wake up. People got to wake up. They're screwing us, and they're killing our kids for no particular reason.
Yeah, I'm with Charlie Rangel on this. We need to have a draft, and the draft needs to include members of Congress and rich people, and, you know, it shouldn't be the kind of thing that, you know, like Dick Cheney. You know, five deferments. George W. Bush, his daddy was a congressman, so he got into the champagne unit of the Texas Air National Guard, and then he even went AWOL for a whole year, and nobody ever sent him to prison for it. It's amazing. Corky, thank you for the call. But, you know, I'm with you. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And apropos of our last guest saying that no president in history has ever basically lobbied the FCC or told them what to do. First of all, my recollection is that it was Ronald Reagan in 78 or in 87, rather, who told the FCC to stop enforcing the Fairness Doctrine. Now, it might be that the FCC just did that on their own. And I've been blaming Reagan for that all these years. I don't have that in print. But here's what George W. Bush did, and a tip of the hat to Shane O'Farnan and Danielle for helping dig this out. President George W. This is from IMDb News. President George W. Bush, while calling himself a free speech advocate, nevertheless said the FCC must call to account, President Bush's comments, any television program that, quote, gets over the line of decency, end quote. In an interview with Brian Lamb of C-SPAN Sunday, the president also said he would ask candidates to succeed Michael Powell as head of the FCC, quote, please tell me where that line, the decency line, is. He said, look, we're a great society because we're a free society. On the other hand, it's important for there to be limits to what parents have to explain to their children. And Bush went on to say, well, they're going to collect a lot of money when some of these TV shows are still on, you know, et cetera. So George W. Bush told the FCC what to do. Interestingly enough. David in Woodland Hills, California. Hey, David, what's on your mind?
Love you, Tom. I'd also like to explain briefly, if there's time, the tragedy of Barack Obama. But the reason I called is several years ago, the LA Weekly, which used to be a great progressive paper, they published a timeline of America at war. And from the beginning of our history, almost 250 years, there's been like 20 to 30 years where we weren't involved, declared or undeclared, somewhere. Either between the Indians or the World Wars, 20, 30 years.
When was that? I can't think of any time when, you know, maybe during the Eisenhower presidency, but even then we had United Fruit was stirring up trouble down in Honduras.
Yeah, but I've been looking for that timeline. I can't find it, but there were actually a couple years where we were peaceful, maybe during Carter's time.
Yeah, Jimmy Carter, I think, is the only president not to intentionally have a, quote, little war to help his political standing. We had 4 years of peace under President Carter.
So we are truly a warrior nation. Can I explain my opinion of Barack Obama, the tragedy of him?
You may.
I believe that he was forced to be a more center-right president because of the obstruction. I think the tragedy was it should have been Hillary first, with Barack as the vice president. Then these racist right-wingers would have gotten more used to him. And after 8 years of Hillary, Barack becomes president. There wouldn't have been the same amount of obstruction. They wouldn't have destroyed his presidency, and he would have been more center-left.
You know, David, whenever we do, we should have, it could have, it would have,
right.
You know, we wander into very dangerous territory. But let me just offer a couple of thoughts. Number one, I think you're to use a Palinism, you're misunderestimating the power of misogyny in our culture. You know, keep in mind, African-Americans got the vote 70 years before women did. And it may well be that a woman president then or, you know, in 2 years will face withering attacks that are even far more explicitly sexist, misogynist, hateful than, you
well,
know.
Remember, these people also
a black president.
Margaret Thatcher.
I beg your pardon?
These people also loved Margaret Thatcher, who was a woman chief executive of her country.
Yeah, so, but Margaret Thatcher was a conservative. Well, Margaret Thatcher was, the very first thing she did when she came into office was take on the coal union, which everybody thought was the most powerful union in all of England, and destroyed it.
Right.
Maggie Thatcher, and then the Falklands, you know, she had her little war so that she could create her bona fides as a warrior. Margaret Thatcher, they called her the Iron Lady. She, you know, if Hillary Clinton were a Republican, I could see that. But Hillary Clinton running as a Democrat, it's going to be very
problematic. But here's the other thing. Hillary would have fought back more. Barack, because he was a black man, he felt, I can't fight back. They'll think I'm the angry black man. Where Hillary could have fought back more and Bill would have helped her. I really believe
maybe
Hillary.
In fact, probably. But again, I, you know, and plus, you know, if Obama had been the vice president for 8 years and now he was running for president, he's of an appropriate age to run for president, and Hillary would have been, you know, of an appropriate age to be president 8 years ago. And I, you know, I could see all that in the positive world, in the perfect world, but that's not what we have. What we have is what we have, and we've had 6 years of absolute seamless obstruction by the Republicans, not for the good of the nation, but exclusively for the destruction of our first black president and a Democrat, and you know, those two things. So it's a twofer from their point of view. And frankly, I think if Hillary comes in, you're going to see the exact same thing because she's a woman. Please don't underestimate the power of misogyny. You know, women make 87 cents on the dollar, and the Republican Party is unified in trying to keep it that way. I mean, they want to say that women's health problems are, you know, let's make the birth control pill either unavailable or over the counter so that you have to pay for it and your insurance can't pay for it. I mean, and most women who take the birth control pill don't do so for contraception. They do so for other reasons, for medical reasons. And Republicans don't care about that. There was an amazing article in the New York Times last week about all the women who've been arrested just because they're pregnant. You know, it's just, quote, they thought that the mother might endanger the child or something like that. I mean, it's just misogyny, the hatred of women, the domination of women by men in this society is less visible to most men than, you know, the apartheid, than racial segregation. But I think it's certainly visible to women. And we're going to see a whole lot of it in the next couple of years. David, thank you for the call. Interesting food for thought. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And any thoughts you may have on Title II and the Internet and all that sort of thing, I'd be interested in hearing. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Where do we go with all this? We have Ted Cruz coming out and saying net neutrality is Obamacare for the Internet. The anti-net neutrality folks are fielding their spokespersons. We had one on earlier in the program, you know, the PR firms that are working for the telco industry or for the ISP industry or for the individual, you know, they're getting their voices out. They're getting, you know, the word out. And frankly, there's very few voices, at least that I'm seeing in the media, who are talking about what real net neutrality really is. And some of that might have to do with the fact that NBC and MSNBC are owned by, in large part, Comcast family, or at least MSNBC is, I believe NBC, I'm not sure. And they'll make a fortune if there's no net neutrality, if they can convert the Internet into a cable TV model. So, and then, you know, how does that translate into how we discuss war and what we do about war? Dwayne in Pelion, South Carolina. Hey, Dwayne, thanks for watching. What's on your mind? Dwayne, you are on the air. Okay, you got to listen to your telephone because there's a delay between the telephone and what you see on TV or hear on the radio. Phyllis in Monita, Virginia. Phyllis, you're on the air.
Yes.
Hi.
It's nice to speak with you for the first time. And before I get to my point, I want to make an unsolicited plug for your Tom Hartman podcast. I'm a subscriber, and it's wonderful because I live in an area that we have very few options for listening to progressive radio.
Well, thank you.
My point with regard to you're welcome. My point with regard to the Internet is that your guest obviously doesn't live in rural America, where a patching together Internet is sort of like in the days when I was young, putting aluminum foil on the rabbit ears of our TV.
Yep.
We have so few options that, Comcast keeps telling us, yeah, maybe in 2 years. I mean, that's been 8 years ago. We might come down your street in 2 years. It doesn't pay for them to come to our home or our neighborhood. There's so few people living there, and we're stuck. We don't get great speeds. We have to literally patch. My husband works from home, and we have to patch together some sort of satellite, cell phone configuration to try to get it to work.
Yeah, one of my brothers lives in rural Michigan, and the best he can get is DSL, which is like, you know, high speed dial up, and it's not even high speed. I mean, it's a joke. And
we can't even get that.
Yeah.
You know, we have satellite TV, and we have, unfortunately, satellite internet. It's not good, but you know, that's where, when you've talked in the past about the rural electrification, I think it is.
Yeah.
This is where our government should be spending money is. You know, we've got students in these rural areas, kids that need access, and adults to work.
Yeah.
You know, home businesses.
I agree. Themselves. We've done this at the federal level twice. It was the REA, the Rural Electrification Administration, in the 30s. And then I believe it was in the 40s. It might have even been the 50s that it was the RTA, the Rural Telephony Administration, that ran telephone lines at government expense out into rural areas because the phone companies didn't want to pay for it. And we need an RIA, a Rural Internet Administration, to be doing the same thing now. I'm totally with you, Phyllis. Thank you for the call. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you this afternoon?
I am great, but I'll get better, Wayne. I hope the same is true for you.
Yes, it's true. I just wanted to comment on your guest. Was he a former FCC chairman?
He was a former FCC commissioner. There are four commissioners and one chairman, I guess.
Oh, okay. He was a former FCC commissioner. Okay. I don't understand why people just don't tell the truth. What Comcast did to Netflix was both blackmail and extortion. They slowed their speeds down. They let them know, we can slow your speed down whenever we want. We want more money. If you don't give us more money, this is what you're going to have to deal with, us playing with your speed.
Right.
So Netflix paid them off. And then as a result of that, Netflix cut Saturday service, like Saturday delivery of their products.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, look. The greed, it's like what Ted Kennedy said. When does the greed stop? And you got this FCC chairman, he's so smug, he's saying that the president shouldn't have said anything. What the hell are you talking about? You guys are trying to take over the internet just like you want to take over that $2.7 trillion surplus in Social Security.
Yep.
It's just ridiculous, man. This country is so greedy and so corrupt. What is the answer, Tom?
The answer is democratic socialism. The answer is for we the people to repudiate Reagan's libertarian assertion that government can do nothing right, that government is evil, and to realize, to re-realize that this government that generation after generation of Americans have fought and died for is us. It's we the people, and it wasn't always we the people. You know, in the early days, it was basically a small group of rich white guys. But now, increasingly, it's we the people. We need to make it even farther. We need to expand that franchise, beyond where it is right now. But the government is us. And it's in only 9 states do you have to study civics to graduate from high school. That's a crime. You know, we've got high school graduates who don't know that there are 3 branches of government, who don't know the history of the country.
Can I make one more comment?
You certainly
even know. David Stockman, Reagan's
budget director
of the Office of Management and Budget,
right.
Even he's come out and said Reaganomics was completely wrong.
Yep.
Trickle down does not work.
Yep.
Continuing to steal from the American people's pocketbooks and purses does not work.
Yeah, David Stockman has said that on this program. You're absolutely right. And by the way, David Stockman still considers himself a good and loyal Republican. But, he would be the first to tell you that Reaganomics was a scam. That's the trickle-down economics, Laffer curve, all that stuff was a scam. And he tried to tell President Reagan that it was a scam and got punished for it. Wayne, excellent call. Thank you so much. You are so spot on, as always. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hello. How are you, Mike Cowell?
How you doing, Mr. Hartman? About your first hour conversation you had with Peter Hart, and you asked about how we can have a reasonable conversation about the mass insanity of this war.
Yeah.
It has to be about calling out the oil and coal companies that have tens of trillions of dollars still in the ground that they are using to balance their balance sheets. Natural resources are why we have wars. So question, would those companies fail if they chose not to extract those profits out of the ground for the betterment of future generations? Thank you, Tom.
Interesting. Yeah, excellent question. Excellent question. Richard, driving through Kentucky, listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Richard, you wanted to comment on net neutrality?
Yeah, well, the net neutrality and just about everything else, that is good for the public in this country, it seems to me like the conservatives and even especially the libertarians seem to think that all of this stuff is supposed to be for sale.
Right.
It's like if somebody can't get filthy rich off of it, it doesn't deserve to exist.
Yep.
And these are the same people that scream about the Constitution, and the constitutionality of taking this stuff public.
Yep.
But, the founding fathers, when they wrote the Constitution and everything else I've ever read that one of the founding fathers wrote, they tended to be very specific and very blunt in their writings. Their stuff didn't, you know, they didn't write one thing, but then there was all this hidden meanings, you know, that you had to read between the lines to figure out. What they wrote is what they meant.
Yeah.
And these people tend to want to take this stuff and interpret it in such a way that it no longer means what they wrote down to begin with. You know, just to justify their profit margins.
Yeah, I don't disagree. The idea of libertarianism is basically spit in George Washington's face, tell him it was a waste of time what he did. We don't need government, thank you very much. We can rely on the billionaires and the big transnational corporations to run everything for us. We can even privatize. I've had libertarians on this program talk about privatizing fire departments and police departments. In fact, there's a few communities in America that have done that. And it's... it's just nuts. It's taking the commons, the common wealth, and taking the common wealth and putting it into the hands of big giant for-profit corporations or billionaires, and there's something fundamentally wrong about that.
Yeah, there was a story that I read recently about a guy in Texas, I think it was, where they had basically not necessarily privatized the fire department, but they had added a tax to every homeowner that not only were they paying their property taxes, but they also had to pay an actual fire department tax. And if they didn't pay that tax, they did not get coverage from the fire department.
Right.
This one particular guy's house caught fire, and the fire department showed up and put water on both of his neighbors' houses because they paid the tax while they watched his place burn to the ground.
Right, and this is how it was in the United States, by the way, during the Gilded Age, the part, you know, that part the libertarians want to go back to, because we had private, for-profit fire companies in many particularly larger cities, and they would sell what are called shields or medallions, and you would put them on your house, and so the for-profit fire company would know which house to take care of and which ones not to. And it was such a disaster to municipality after municipality said, screw this, we'll run our own.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Excellent point. Thanks for calling and making it. We'll be back with more of your calls and my thoughts and the news of the day. And we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service too. A lot coming up here. Stick around. Oh, and Lee Fong's going to be with us. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Alan watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Beaumont, Texas. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I want to first tell you that I really enjoy you and your show. I think you're, you know, a great person and all that. But I did have a bit of a critique for you. You know, like if you look back at the history of this country, you know, the two overriding principles that the people had, you know, who founded the country. I don't even like calling them founding fathers, but it was race and wealth. You know, if you were anything other than white, shame on you. And if you just happen to be, you know, white and a female or poor, then shame on you also. So, you know, we can't act like we're surprised today, you know, like when these people still, you know, they want to promote all these policies. You know, and I'm going to just give you the four of them that, you know, their favorite policies are today, you know, like voter ID, drug testing, welfare, and unemployment recipients, and, you know, school vouchers. Okay, you know, back before the Civil War, you know, afterwards, well, not before, but, you know, certainly afterwards, you know, their home was in the Democratic Party, but now, today is, you know, it's the Republican Party. And the thing I, you know, and that's one thing I, you know, I kind of like would be my criticism of Obama and maybe you to a certain extent. You just can't be nice with these people. You know, I'm not saying you should call them names or anything like that, but you have to call them out for what they are. You know, it's like, for instance, I really wanted to talk to you Thursday, that guy you had on your show. But it's amazing to me, like, if these policies are so good and so beneficial, you know, like breathing clean air, then they should want everybody to experience it, right?
Yeah.
But it's always, you know, when you look at these policies and where they try to enact them at, it's only in states where there's a significant minority population. Mm-hmm. You know, they control South Dakota, Wyoming, North Dakota, Montana, Idaho. And I'm not saying they don't have any laws that are not good, that they you know, are in favor of. But you don't ever hear about them trying to enact those laws, like, you know, what I just mentioned, in those states. I'm not aware of any, you know, and over the past, what, 5 or 6 years, thousands of schools, public schools have been closed, you know, tried to be boxerized and all of that. I'm not aware of one affluent, predominantly white high school in this country that's been shut down, you know, with those type of efforts.
Yeah. And let me apply that to voting also. The state that has the most liberal voting rules in the country. You can show up, you can register, you can vote all on the same day, and you don't have to present identification, is North Dakota. North Dakota is entirely Republican, but it's also almost entirely white. The larger the minority population in a state, the more likely it is that Republicans will have passed voter ID laws. Similarly, the larger the minority population is in a state, the more likely it is that they will have pushed charter schools, particularly for-profit charter schools, on people. And similarly, the larger the minority population, the more likely they'll have toxic waste dumps and all kinds of awful stuff. I mean, you're absolutely right. The history of the founding of this republic, of the people of power and privilege basically crapping on everybody else, and are taking advantage of them or killing them, in the case of Native Americans and African Americans, people brought here from Africa, is absolutely still with us. And these guys want to carry it on. Alan, thank you for the call. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org, where there's new news, by the way. Be sure to check out free-don.org. Don Siegelin may be having a hearing in the middle of December. Victoria Jones is with us for the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
Well, I've got lots of climate news to start with, different bits of it.
I see that you're at the White House.
I am, yes. It's a pretty snoozy White House. I have already observed at least one reporter asleep.
Okay.
They are exhausted after their trip to Asia, and some of them have had to come in.
Yeah, so jet lag is hitting them.
Yeah, they don't have beds on the plane, unlike some people.
Right.
Okay. One person, let's put it that way.
Yeah. And his wife, should she choose to accompany him.
Indeed. And in fact, that person, President Obama, on climate, is shifting his focus towards the fight against global warming at home. Senior administration officials saying Vice President Biden is meeting today with state, local, and tribal leaders who sit on the president's task force on climate preparedness and resilience. Now, this task force consists of 8 governors, 16 mayors, and 2 tribal leaders, and they're meeting with Biden and other officials to present recommendations on how best the federal government can help them respond to extreme weather and other climate change impacts in communities across the U.S.
Hmm.
They're also going to, the White House is going to unveil new actions to help state, local, and tribal leaders build healthy and resilient towns and fight climate change. Things like a web-based climate resilience toolkit that helps planners and decision makers easily access federal tools to better prepare communities for droughts, rising sea levels, harsher storms, and other climate change impacts, things like that. So there's that going on. Meanwhile, the president of a South Dakota-based Native American tribe called the Rosebud Sioux says it will be an act of war if Congress authorizes construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. President Cyril Scott said in a statement, "We are outraged by the lack of intergovernmental cooperation. We are a sovereign nation, and we are not being treated as such." He said, "We will close our reservation borders to the Keystone XL, authorizing Keystone XL is an act of war against our people." In addition, members of the Wicca Agli, a Native American activist group, arrived in Washington, D.C. today to back Scott and the Cowboy Indian Alliance, which is a multi-state activist organization, as the Senate prepares to vote on Keystone tomorrow.
Wow. Last I heard, they had
59
votes. They're still there.
Yeah, that's the last I heard. I mean, there's so much
Do you know who is filibustering it, or is it Harry Reid himself?
Don't know who's filibustering it. I mean, basically, they just are trying to get somebody else to come over.
Yeah.
Meantime, a number of environmental activists, including Nebraskans, local students, and climate activists, are protesting the pipeline today outside the Washington, D.C. home of Senator Mary Landrieu. Demonstrators will have an inflatable pipeline that they plan to lay across Landrieu's front yard.
Yeah, that's, you know, in Louisiana, that's going to help her.
Yes,
tragically.
Indeed.
By the way, go ahead. I'm sorry. Never mind.
No. Chief John Belmar of St. Louis County, who is the police chief leading the response to protests over the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, has been accused of dishonesty by demonstrators after he's denied on St. Louis Public Radio that officers shot at them with rubber bullets, and he claimed that only criminals were tear gassed. He said, "We didn't use rubber bullets. If they're actually rubber bullets, they'll kill you." He went on to say in this public radio interview that tear gas and smoke grenades had not been fired at, quote, peaceful protesters, adding, "We used that on unfortunate criminal activity that span out of the protests." Well, people are kicking back at that, saying, well, wait a second, reporters were tear gassed.
Right.
All kinds of people were tear gassed. And how do you define a rubber bullet? So there's quite a lot of kickback on that.
Yeah, there's a small element of do you want to believe him or believe your lion eyes?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Senate Democratic leaders today have urged President Obama to use his executive powers to make changes to the country's immigration system. They've outlined major revisions they'd like to see included. This is Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and five other senior Democratic leaders have said they fully support his decision to use what they've described as his well-established executive authority. They want him to expand the Dreamers program to include parents of the 600 or so people who'd been approved. They also want him to provide help to certain illegal immigrants who are parents of U.S. citizens and permanent residents, and workers who play a vital role in our economy and heritage. And they also hope that he will improve the legal immigration system to keep immigrant families together, protect workers, and allow employers to sponsor more talented immigrants for U.S. citizenship.
Good.
So we'll see. Meanwhile, Senator Rob Portman, a Republican of Ohio, is saying that Republicans will be adamant about blocking President Obama's executive order if he issues it before Congress passes a government funding bill. And the date for that is a looming December 11 date for keeping the government open.
Right. Do you think that he will announce it the day after so as not to give them an opportunity to build something into that bill that would prevent that, or will they do it no matter what?
Well, I'm getting kind of intrigued with the idea that he's going to do a pre-Thanksgiving drop.
Mm-hmm.
Not for any reason except that it would sort of fall into the hollow of the post-Thanksgiving week of nothing going on.
Right, right.
But I'm not basing that on anything.
Hmm. I think your instincts might be right.
It could be quite wrong. Meanwhile, Senator Ed Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, today pressed the Justice Department for more information on a totally scary program that collects American cell phone data using airplanes equipped with technology that it mimics cell towers. It's actually fake cell towers.
Right. Now, we've got either 13 or 18 of these fake cell towers in Washington, D.C., according to the Washington Times. Have you seen any, and in the Wall Street Journal, have you seen any further reporting on those?
No, I've not seen any further reporting on those.
Huh, interesting. Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you, as always. We will be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer. maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And on the line with us, one of the finest investigative reporters working in the United States today, Lee Fong, investigative reporter with both The Nation and RepublicReport.com. TheNation.com is The Nation's website. And Lee has a new piece on The Nation about how the president could reform our dark money problem with the stroke of a pen. Lee, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thank you so much for having me.
It's always great talking with you. So, first of all, can you define for us the scope of the dark money problem and, for that matter, define dark money?
Well, Tom, we have a situation today in America where hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent to elect the new Congress, and the source of that money is a mystery. It does not have to be disclosed. Dark, untraceable money really became a problem in modern American campaigns following the Citizens United decision in 2010, basically by taking away the need for campaign donors to come from individuals, allowing corporate money to flow into elections, created this problem because, you know, a corporation is only just legal fiction, right? Anyone can create a nonprofit or for-profit company and create a series of shell companies and conceal their donation once this trigger was made. So in the last three elections, we've seen the amount of dark, untraceable money typically pumped into the campaign system through 501c3 and c4 and c6 nonprofits. This problem has been growing, but in the last congressional election, we saw the largest amount of dark money. We really don't know the identities of who bought the latest Congress, the new Republican Senate majority, and many of the new freshmen coming into Congress.
Right. So basically, our nation, our elected officials have been put up for sale by the Supreme Court, and we don't even know who owns them. So what's your proposed solution?
Well, this was an idea first floated by the Barack Obama administration in 2011, following the first dark money election in 2010. But this idea is that that President Obama can issue an executive order today and require that companies or individuals receiving federal contracts disclose their dark money payments, because of this relationship they have with the federal government.
Which would be, probably 80-90% of the Fortune 500?
Yeah, potentially even more than that, because even some of the more obscure privately held companies have federal government contracts, and almost all of the large publicly traded companies do, whether it's through pharmaceutical companies have NIH grants, even Polk Industries have federal contracts through the Department of Defense. So this executive order wouldn't touch everybody, but it would touch a large portion of the companies in America.
Yeah, and it's the companies that have federal contracts that are the most aggressive in passing out money and lobbying because they want to get more money from the federal government. What does Koch Industries have to do with the Department of Defense?
Koch Industries, through their Georgia-Pacific subsidiary, they make a lot of the siding and roofing and different timber products that are used by the military. So they've got huge federal contracts, and they also have fuel-related federal contracts with the military.
Wow.
So this is a relationship they're not going to give up, but, of course, Koch Industries doesn't want to disclose where they're giving their money.
Right. Do you Have you gotten any feedback on this? Do you know if the president or the others in his administration, you said that they suggested this back in 2011. Is there any kind of modern day top of mind awareness on this? Do you think, you know, what do you think the chances are of something like this happening?
Unfortunately, I think the chances are pretty slim. You know, I think I'm the only person talking about this. I've gone on a couple other radio programs, and there's a lot of interest from the grassroots. A lot of activists have emailed me, but I haven't seen any of the other campaign finance reform or good government groups really talk about this, except for Public Citizen. And you don't see this a loud discussion in the media about this. But, you know, when Obama floated this idea in 2011, the business community went ballistic. One of the most powerful business lobbying groups, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, actually threatened violence over this. They said that, you know, if Obama goes through with this, you know, we're going to respond like the NATO forces responded in Libya. All options are on the table. I mean, it was...
Wait, they're going to bomb the White House?
That's the quote they used on the front page of the New York Times. So that gives you the degree of seriousness.
Holy cow.
They take secret money. It was quite a provocative quote. In any case, the Obama administration has complete liberty to do this now, but I suspect the dynamic that's pushing in the other direction, not only is the business community very protective of their secret money, because many of their corporate donors would not give that money if they had to be revealed. Many of them have consumer products and they don't want the political backlash. But the other dynamic here is that Democrats have taken advantage of dark money too. In this previous election, Republicans used more dark money than Democrats by a 3-to-1 margin. That being said, Democrats have embraced this too, and this executive order is neutral. It would apply to both sides, and you'd see a lot of embarrassing details about companies that give to Democratic dark money groups, including the groups backing Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. And presumably unions as well. This would not limit itself for for-profit corporations.
This would go.
Although the unions are self-disclosing anyway, aren't they?
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing. You know, some police unions and other state-affiliated public sector unions have less disclosure requirements, but large national affiliates have to disclose every penny of their donations. So we actually know where most of the unions.
Yeah, in fact, wasn't that part of Taft-Hartley?
Yeah, the some of the follow-up amendments to Taft-Hartley in the 50s concerned union disclosure. That was after a lot of the corruption and mob-related scandals in the 50s. But, yeah, large unions have to disclose every dime of their spending, even to dark money groups.
Yeah. So what can our listeners and our viewers do to encourage this administration? I mean, is there something on change.org? Is it a matter of call the White House? Is this the kind of thing where you try to influence members of Congress? Or is it just, hey, tell 10 friends and spread the word? You know, with an executive order, the president could say anybody who does business with the government, which is pretty much every big company, has to disclose all of their dark money contributions. Is that, you know, what's your suggestion? Where do we go from here?
It's hard to say. I think just making noise is the best thing possible, because right now, you know, Obama's considering some other executive orders, but I don't even know what his position on this type of executive order is today. So I think calling the White House is a good idea, calling even campaign finance organizations and calling members of Congress and asking where they stand. I think all of that is good proactive activity. And this is important, because really, as members of the public or members of the media, we have no idea who purchased our latest round of congressional leaders. And to really understand what's going on Capitol Hill, to understand what's motivating our policymakers, this is crucial information.
Yeah, absolutely. And so well said. So back in 2011, when the Obama administration was in favor of this, was the president on record, or was this just some administration person?
This is what they call in Washington, D.C., a trial balloon. They kind of anonymously leaked from, you know, a senior White House official the idea to D.C. media. So D.C. media, Politico, The Hill, The Washington Post reported on this, and that's when we started seeing the backlash from business groups. And many on Capitol Hill, you saw congressional Republicans saying, oh, this is an effort to silence the president's opponents. This executive order wouldn't silence anyone. This would just force companies to have the courage to stand by their own speech. The executive order would not actually limit anything. It would only provide more transparency.
Amazing. Lee Fong, writing over at The Nation, thenation.com. Lee, thanks for dropping by.
Tom, take care. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Lee is one of the... Lee and Matt Taibbi, I think, are the... Well, and now you got Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras. I got to get over and see that movie. They're just doing it. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Hazel watching Free Speech TV in Deming, New Mexico. Hey, Hazel, what's on your mind today?
I was wondering, what do you think Obamacare, where is this going? Is it going anywhere? Is she going to use it? Is it powers, executive powers, or what?
The
overrides the Republicans.
Yeah, the biggest challenge to Obamacare right now is the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court could rule in a way that could substantially harm Obamacare, and the Republicans, of course, could fix that. I mean, there's a one-sentence piece of legislation that could fix the quote, problem with Obamacare that the Supreme Court has taken up. But this Supreme Court is so political, they will do anything they can to destroy this president. So... You know, we have to wait and see. We don't have any way of pressuring the Supreme Court because they have lifetime appointments and they just don't care what we have to say or think, and they do whatever they damn well please. On the other hand, there are ways around it. If the Supreme Court says that you can't get a subsidy if your state doesn't have an exchange, then I have a feeling that a lot of states are going to get exchanges really quick, and then what we're going to see is the red and blue state divide grow even wider than it is right now. But... Does that make sense, Hazel?
Yes. What about immigration? Is it going anywhere?
Yeah, I think he's going to protect the families he's going to give people a work permits and a path to citizenship and stop deporting families of people who are, you know, in that track or who are already married to an American, that sort of thing. One of my nieces is married to a fellow from Mexico who was here without documentation, and they had to flee to Mexico. I mean, they've got several children, and they had to leave the country. I mean, it's amazing what's going on. And this would solve that problem. So I believe that the
president... Sign right away.
Pardon?
He can do it. Sign right away.
Yeah, he can. And, you know, the question is the timing. You know, when is he going to do it? Victoria Jones's theory is he's going to do it right around Thanksgiving when the news cycle is kind of dead and nobody's paying attention to what's going on. I don't know.
Override the Republicans.
Yeah, yeah. He will definitely do it, I think, before the end of the year. There's no doubt about that. He's trying to give the Republicans an opportunity to pass the bill in the House that already passed the Senate, but John Boehner is still refusing to bring that bill up for consideration. So, Hazel, thank you for the call. Larry in Pulaski, Pennsylvania. We got a minute to the break. Larry, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Oh, boy. Okay, I'll try to get this in. Come January, they're going to impeach this president. And what
I think it'll probably be more like May, but I agree.
But they're going to start talking big time.
Yeah.
But what I want LeBron James and the sports world to do, and all the people in Hollywood say, that day it comes, I want them all not to show up for work. That's what I'm.
So you're calling for a national strike?
Yeah.
In solidarity with the president?
If that does happen, say they will. If they impeach Cheney and Bush for their war crime, and then they could go ahead and then they won't go from there. But not until they impeach. First, we got to get things first. Impeach Cheney and Bush.
Yeah, and it's not too late, by the way, to impeach Cheney and Bush. Even though they're no longer in office, they can still be impeached and they can still be convicted. Larry, very interesting. Thank you very much for the call. Great suggestion. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. Oh, this is interesting. I need to dig into this a little more, but the Chiron on CNN right now says that the 20th hijacker, I think his name was Moussaoui, the guy who never got on the plane and they arrested him and he's in prison, has apparently written a letter saying that a Saudi prince financed 9/11. I'll dig out some more details and share them with you as time goes on. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Well, how to stop war. First of all, one caller said we got to vote. Well, of course, but we also have to make sure the votes are counted correctly, and we've totally dropped that issue.
Yep.
But the other thing, path to war, stopping war is personal. I mean, there are lots of things we can do worldwide, but the personal things we can do are very powerful. And, you know, I talk about religion and politics to just about anybody and definitely avoid arguing. But I found there's much more agreement than disagreement with people who supposedly have opposite views. And so the steps, I'd say, first, so humanize our so-called opponent. You know, start feeling, thinking, and most importantly, acting in a we manner. We have to start thinking we all the time. Get rid of the whole stop, even forget the word them. Mm-hmm. And stop the divisive name-calling. And then also separate the person from the idea. So when you're talking to people, it's like George Lakoff said this rather well. You know, make the idea in error, not the person.
Right.
Yeah, because people react to get very protective, you know, very defensive when you make them wrong. But they could have been presented the wrong idea. The other thing is ask them questions. You've got to understand their view if you're going to, you know, understand. If you really want to understand it, ask them questions.
Yeah, do you think any of this policy prescription you're describing, and they're good common sense things, and more often than not, they're the things that guide the way that I debate with these folks. Do you think any of them would have caused George W. Bush and Dick Cheney not to invade Iraq?
No. The thing is we've got to start someplace. We've got to start with us. Because, you know, the thing is there are the massive things we can do internationally. There's the massive things we can do nationally and statewide and so forth. But we've got to start with the personal thing because right now, like my ex-girlfriend, her father, he had seemed like he would disagree with me on everything. We had to sit down and talk, and we agreed on like 90% of the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we found that out, we started, you know, there's a door open to possibly voting the same way.
Right.
So it could have prevented people like Bush from getting into office because oftentimes I find people vote who totally agree or say agree on 90% of the issues may vote in an opposite manner.
Mm-hmm.
And once you start opening this dialogue, it can change the way they vote.
Yeah.
Possibly the way I vote.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's the thing. So, yes, it could change the way Bush does things because it could prevent Bush from getting in there.
Interesting.
And I really recommend this before, two things. One is search for common ground. And you go by their initials, sfcg.org, and their techniques are wonderful. The other one on how not to do it, Vice TV, you know, I think it's vice.com, they have a fabulous series on the Ukraine. And you can see the march to war and the dehumanizing of people is just awful. And people who used to be friends and neighbors just a couple of years ago are now dehumanizing each other.
Yeah, and it's getting worse as we watch. You're right.
Yeah, so we got to start someplace, and it starts with us. We're the ones who are affecting the future of the world, not everybody else. It's we, not them.
Yeah, was it Gandhi who said, be the change that you want to see?
Yes.
Yeah, there you go. Jeff, well said. Thank you very much for the call. It's always nice to hear from you. Maine in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Maine, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Norm? Tom, I'm sorry. I'll be calling Norm Mangold, man.
It's okay.
But,
he's a good guy, too.
Yeah. But I wanted to just speak on, you know, what you said about the billionaires. I have this thing it says in the Bible you can't serve God and mammon. Well, here in this secular world, you can't serve mammon and man being like the commons or the government, and like the Koch brothers being, you know, mammon. I mean, their God is in God we trust. And they don't see us or the rest of the people as having any significance. Mm. They, excuse me. They are, oh, go ahead. I lost my thought.
That's okay. No, and for people who don't know what you're talking about, mammon, you know, this Jesus made this little, not little, he gave a speech and he said you can't serve God and mammon. And mammon is basically wealth. It's the physical world, but not just the physical world. I mean, you can serve, you can conserve, you can help the physical world. But he was like, you know, you have to get your priorities straight. And I agree with it. Did you want to talk about the super rich being hoarders, Maine? Do I have that right?
Being hoarders. They're like a hoarder who starts in the basement, then goes to the attic, fills it up, then his house is full.
I mean, then his garage, then he goes to his garage, fills it, fills the garage, and then buys storage space, fills it.
Yeah.
And storage space would be like equal to these offshore accounts in the Cayman Islands and stuff. That's their storage rooms. I mean, they have billions upon billions of dollars, but yet they want more billions upon billions of dollars. I mean, and they're willing to spend $2-3 billion to make $5 or $6 billion.
Sure.
And they continue to hoard the money. They don't allow it to trickle down. They just hoard it. So they have a sickness just like a hoarder does.
Yeah, I don't disagree. It's a variation on obsessive-compulsive disorder. And just like some people fill their houses with newspapers, some, not all, but some of the super rich are just like all they can think about is getting more money, more. And it's a mental illness. And it's a very tragic mental illness. And, you know, at some point, there has to be a sense of enough. Okay, I've got enough. You know, we can make do with this. And that's why we came up with this website, nobillionaires.com, in which we suggested that, you know, all wealth over $1 billion should be taxed at 100%. Maine, thanks a lot for the call, because it's not good for the country. It's not good for the country for that much wealth to be in such a small number. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
28 minutes past the hour. The NFL dispensing illegal painkillers. Is it time to ban football? It's the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program, and welcome back. So pleased to have you with us and to be with you. It's really such a privilege to do this show. By the way, over the weekend, Louise and I went to see two movies. You know, we don't normally see, we could go a year without seeing a movie, but this weekend we saw that. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes, I guess, you know, Intergalactic, I think it's called, the movie about, you know, off in search of other planets. It was a pretty good show. Interstellar. Thank you, Louise. I didn't think it was a masterpiece. You know, it was a masterpiece of filmmaking in as much as the graphics and the sets and the scene. I mean, it cost over $100 million to make. It was beautiful. And the story was interesting. And the physics were fascinating. And, you know, there were a few tear-jerking moments. And it was a nice movie. You know, I still thought Django was a better movie. But, you know, I like action films. And then yesterday we went to watch A Theory of Everything, the new movie about Stephen Hawking. And the other movie that we want to watch next weekend is the new movie out about Ed Snowden, Citizen Four. We have not yet seen that. But the movie about Stephen Hawking was beautiful and moving. I read a Brief History of Time when it came out back in the, 80s, I think it was, maybe the 70s, and became a Stephen Hawking fan and have followed his career over the years. And it's amazing he's still alive. I mean, he was given 2 years to live 30 years ago or thereabouts. Well, I'm not going to criticize the movie or give it away. I just, you know, it's a movie worth seeing. It's really a movie worth seeing. So just a heads up on that. Dwayne in Pellion, South Carolina, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Dwayne, what's on your mind?
Hello, mate.
Dwayne, you are on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome. What's up?
I was wanting to talk to you about when you're talking about the warmongers.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's all about money. That's all it is.
Of course.
And the 1% who are run by the 1% of the 1%.
Yep.
Life is I said, so easy to get along with, long as you don't know what everybody, what's really happening and what's really going on.
So what's your solution, Dwayne?
Blindsided. Isn't that how the American population is?
Yeah, I think, you know, the title of Bob Ney's book, Sideswiped, describes it pretty well. What's your solution?
As far as the mongers go, man, I would say give Putin a gun, give Obama a gun, man.
Oh, yeah. Dwayne, nice idea, but I don't think it's going to happen. Mike, it's not even a nice idea. Michael in Claremont, California. Hey, Michael.
Yes, good morning, Tom.
If I may, by the way, just apropos of the last caller, complaining is easy. Finding problems is easy. Finding solutions is hard work. And Henry Ford used to have a sign on his door, or it might be an apocryphal story, but I've read it in a number of different places, that said, if you bring a problem and you don't bring a possible solution, you're fired. And, you know, I think that there's something to be said for that as I'm not a fan of management by dictatorship, but I've always in my life, and I learned this when I was in my teens, the story about Henry Ford, whenever I see a problem, the first question I ask myself is, what's the possible solution? Back to you, Michael.
Yes. Good morning, Tom. I wanted to say something about your question about how we can have a rational conversation about war. Now, I listened to your Veterans Day broadcast last week. Really enjoyed that. When you posed the question as to whether or not, in addition to thanking U.S. veterans for their service, we should apologize to them. So first off, I want to say I definitely think we should apologize to them for the horribly poor treatment that they're getting. And after the apology, I think we should do whatever we can to improve that situation and bring them home ASAP. I hope that one day we can apologize to them for appropriating their physical bodies and exploiting their ignorance of why we go to war. Now, I'll get to my question in a second here, but, after more than a decade of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, they've produced virtually no positive outcomes, and listing the negative outcomes here would take up the entire segment. So that said, our soldiers are essentially in service to the obscene profits being made by the war and weapons industry, as you know. So in view of that, the question I want to ask you is precisely what service we are thanking these warriors, wounded or otherwise, for. I mean, they're not over there to build schools and hospitals, so talk about being rational here. How is it rational to oppose the war and at the same time claim to support our troops and thank them for their service? I mean, what am I missing here?
What you're missing, Michael, is the soldiers are not involved in policy decisions. Most of the people, now that we have a volunteer army, which Thomas Jefferson was wildly opposed to, he said, and I'm pretty sure this is a verbatim quote, it's been a couple of years since I read it, but he said, I hope that I shall never live to see the day when our young men are willing to be shot at for a sixpence. That he referred to this as a pauper army. He said other nations have pauper armies. We do not, and hopefully we never shall. We now have a pauper army. There's a large percentage of people who go into the military simply because there's no other job available. It's a reasonable income, and you can even turn it into a reasonable career. Those are fine reasons to join the military. And then in the midst of that, I mean, you know, it's there are very few professions where when you join the profession, there's a very real possibility that you are going to die. Police officers, firefighters, and the military are pretty much it. You know, if you become a teacher or a rocket scientist or a physician or a, you know, fill in the blank, any other profession or blue collar professions even, odds are you're not going to die. Construction worker, garbage collector. But in the military, there's that very real chance. And I think that we need to separate, and this is kind of apropos of the comments that Jeff was making earlier about not personalizing. You know, if you get into a disagreement with somebody, don't call them a fool, call their idea a fool, or a foolish, rather. That our soldiers are not the ones who made the decision to go into Iraq. That was the war criminals, Bush, Cheney, Rice, Wolfowitz, those guys. And they should not bear the brunt for that. They, you know, like I said, we should apologize to them for having empowered these guys and allowed them to, and not spoken out more loudly and, you know, not done whatever we can. But they're, you know, when a soldier goes into war, They're not thinking about the geostrategic implications or geopolitical implications of it. They're thinking about, I don't want to die, and I don't want the guy next to me to die. He's got my back. I've got his back. This is what we're here for. And I can't fault that. I think that all of us have to honor that, because there are times, there have been times in our past, there will be times in our future when we actually do need warriors. Am I making sense?
Yes, actually, that helps quite a bit, and I appreciate that. And I just had another quick comment with regard to, someone had mentioned Denis Kucinich's proposed Department of Peace earlier. I just want to say, I mean, you know, of course, Department of Peace, it sounds like such a sweet deal to, you know, peaceniks such as myself and you and Marianne Williamson, but in my view, such a department could only be viable if Denis and his supporters can figure out some way to make a Department of Peace, in a world of global capitalism, more profitable than the so-called defense industry.
Right. I think that that's possible, Michael. I really do.
Really?
If we were to, and this would take a very large consensus, but if we were to make making war an immoral act in all but the most extreme of circumstances, and go back and read Markings, which is Dag Hammarskjöld's autobiography, his diaries that he kept when he was the second. Pardon?
Could you repeat that title?
Yeah, the title is Markings, M-A-R-K-I-N-G-S, it was his. When Louise and I owned the ad agency in Atlanta back in the late 80s, early 90s, we had about 200 clients. I bought 200 copies of the book and gave them out to all of our clients. A little 60-page book. But it's amazing. I mean, he was the second as Secretary General of the United Nations after U Thant back in the 50s and the 60s, and died in a plane crash over Angola trying to broker peace. And what they were saying, what they were doing, I mean, what the goal of the United Nations was, and what we agreed to when we signed the UN Charter, was that we will not go to war unless we are attacked first, or unless all the nations of the world, or at least all the members of the Security Council, all of them, because it's a consensus, one person can veto it, agree that this is an appropriate war. And so if we could create, if we could continue that logic, if we had another Dag Hammarskjöld level diplomat who promoted this, and Jimmy Carter actually does, to say war is morally wrong. But what's morally right is building schools for girls, is building good governance, is building infrastructure for countries, is building water supplies, is building septic systems, is going into the Democratic Republic of Congo and South Sudan and helping them build infrastructure. I've been in South Sudan. It's a country the size of Texas, and it has 500 miles of paved road. We can do these things, and we can do them with the mechanism that we call our military, and we can do them in a way that's profitable. So that's my suggestion, Michael. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And, you know, John Kennedy got us going in this direction, him and Sergeant Shriver with the Peace Corps. Remember the Peace Corps? I mean, there was a time when this was our dream. Welcome back. Cindy in Euclid, Ohio. Hey, Cindy. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to tell you what I listened in on when I was monitoring good old Rush Limburger.
Oh, my.
He was railing against the net neutrality. He told his listeners that all you need to know is the source. It puts in mind Adolf Hitler's quote, every educated person is a future enemy. And he encourages ignorance, as always, and just basically his partisan principles.
Yeah, tragically.
Ridiculous as they may be.
Yeah. And he's got a very, very large microphone given to him by some of the largest corporations in the radio industry. It's a lot
of ditto heads, as they call themselves, listening.
Yeah, it's really tragic. Cindy, thanks for the heads.
Something about the war machine. Perhaps one solution, just a first step, would be to bring home the manufacturers, like Lockheed Martin, for instance, in the Netherlands. Perhaps Pim Fortuyn would still be alive. He went against depending their entire economy on Lockheed Martin, or not their entire economy, but a great deal of it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, he was assassinated. They're very dangerous people, unfortunately. And if we find them something better to do with their manufacturing capabilities and still pour money into their pockets.
Yeah, that was my point. Have them build schools. Have them build water treatment
exactly.
programs. Have them build sewage systems. Have them solarize countries. And yeah, I mean, you've got countries, a large chunk of the planet, where people are using wood as their principal heating and lighting source, and we could leapfrog that whole carbon cycle. They wouldn't even have to go through fossil fuels, just move them directly from wood to solar panels. And
it would be something the Department of Peace could initiate.
Well, it's something the Department of Defense could do, because these people, you know, if you go into a country and you actually help them rather than blowing up their country, they're going to be your ally.
Exactly, right, yeah.
So they will, you know, they would like us if we did this. Cindy, thank you for the call. Excellent points, all. Brian in Matthews, North Carolina. Hey, Brian, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
So how are you this afternoon?
I'm great. What's on your mind?
It was in the last hour with John, I believe his name was called, with the libertarian point of view.
Yeah.
I have a few friends like that, and really, I hate to call them friends, but I'm open to, you know, differences. But
yeah.
They take two narrow points and they run with them. They just keep, you know, what's that term, proselytizing the same points over and over and over again. I said, well, they often caucus with the Republican view to where capitalism just runs everything, it'll take care of itself. How does that benefit you at your level? And they can never answer that.
Right.
But what do you mean? I just think if everything goes well, it works well. I said, so you're going on the all boats floats or all the sea float? I mean, I have to get that terminology.
Right. It was Jack Kennedy said a rising tide lifts all boats. But the problem is you got to have a boat.
Right. And well, how does it help you? And no one can ever answer that. I mean, even some of the most learned people I know cannot answer that.
Right.
My other point is we have to learn to discern. I mean, that's something I've been saying for 10 years, and most people don't even know what discern means. But you have to learn to discern. You have to learn to know what you're hearing, what you're listening at, and be able to decipher it and then run with it. I think we have a problem in society where we just want to belong to some party or some group or whatever. And so as long as we belong, we don't have to know anymore if they'll take care of them.
I agree, Brian. It's almost like a tribal instinct. This is my group, you know. And discernment is, yeah, vital. You know, it's the ability to distinguish. Thank you, Brian. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour. Ann in Bellingham, Washington, listening on KBAI. Hey, Ann, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I just have a quote from a Jewish source. It says, there must be more to life than having everything.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just like I saw that billionaire or whatever it is, Zell, and he was going, you have to stop envying us and start to emulate us. And I'm kind of going, who would want to? I mean, I agree with you. I think that people that need that kind of money are mentally ill.
Yeah. Well, some of them. They're, you know,
yeah.
I know a couple of billionaires who are quite decent people and, you know, tend to be progressives, and I've known a couple of billionaires in my life who've just been absolutely miserable. And
yeah.
It's like, you know, where what you think about all day long is what you become, you know.
Yeah.
And the people who obsess on their money tend not to have good lives. On the other hand, there are people who look at their money as a gift and use it for good things. And
that's true.
Yeah.
That is true.
So, I mean, we can't paint all billionaires with the same brush.
Right. Well, no, I know that. We can't. I mean, everyone's individual. I know that to be true.
Yeah.
But when we were talking about the net neutrality, I was thinking that if it's not kept neutral, then we will be having an emblem of oligarchy, and that will rip apart our democracy more and more.
Yeah. Yeah. What these companies want to do is they want to market the internet the way that they market cable TV. You know, oh, you want the entertainment package? That's an extra $20. You know, if you want you want the news package, it's an extra $10. You want the international package, it's an extra $30. And they'll come up with these ways to slice and dice the internet and charge you for bits and pieces of it. And in some cases, they've even rolled out their plans to do this. And it's just absolutely wrong.
Yeah.
And I got to move along. But thank you very much for the call. And thank you for your kind comments. Kevin in Iowa City, Iowa. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, I had an aha moment in the last couple months about how to stop war, and it has to do with Ray Rice, the beheading of the people from ISIS and the video of the police in New York City.
Right.
I think that we could, if we start showing our young men and women with their heads blown off and our soldiers killed every day, like they have, you know, instead of just not showing the coffins or showing the right. coffins and saying they're heroes, when we start seeing how bad war is and start seeing people coming back with their uniforms on and their legs blown off, then we might have a visceral reaction that we did when we saw Ray Rice punch his wife.
Yeah.
Or where it changed the conversation altogether.
I absolutely agree with you, Kevin. And I can tell you from the year that I lived in Europe, European television, or at least much European television, is very different than American television in the way that they portray conflicts. As I recall, the Bosnian conflict was going on at that time, and you know, we saw bodies blown apart and you know, blood on the streets and stuff like that. That here they censor. In fact, CNN International will show things that CNN domestically won't. It's like American sensibilities are just too fragile. No, we really need to see the world. I think you're absolutely right, and I think it would. And in fact, I would say that those pictures that came back from Vietnam in 66, 67, 68, in particular, when CBS and Walter Cronkite was leading the charge, although Huntley and Brinkley did a good job on NBC as well, of actually showing what was going on in Vietnam and showing, you know, dead and dying soldiers on live national television. That led to the end of that war, and we haven't done it since then. And I think we haven't done it since then because everybody realizes that it led to the end of the war. Kevin, thank you for the call. Brilliant point. Bob in Sherman Oaks, California. Hey, Bob, suggestions for stopping war?
Yes, I'd like to give you a few ideas that I don't think I've heard on your program. And number one, we are the only nation in the world. The only nation in the world, there may be one very small, that has a Pledge of Allegiance that's said every day. We start brainwashing our children about patriotism, under God, of course, at age 4 in preschool. I'm an educator, and where they don't allow prayer in school, I'd almost rather they pray a Christian prayer than we stand there and pledge to patriotism. The flag lobby got it on every school building, and when they ran out of school buildings, the flag lobby in the 1800s, I think it was, late 1800s, got flags in every single classroom. Nobody in the world. So when you start brainwashing your children at 5 years old, you can expect that they are going to end up believing in a country as if it was a holy thing.
Now, I've been in other countries where they don't just do that. They take it a step beyond that. When I first went into Kenya in 79 or 80, Daniel Arap Moi was the president. There was a law that every business, every store I walked into, there was a picture of Moi, you know, the President Moi. And I couldn't figure this out. And a fellow, an old British guy who was staying in my hotel, told me that there's a law that says that every 100 linear feet of wall space, there has to be a picture of Daniel Moi. So if you've got a store that's got 200 or 300 feet of wall space, you know, horizontally, you've got 2 or 3 pictures of Daniel Moi. I mean, we're not unique in this.
With that statement then to every Western European, et cetera, country, none of them do that. And they do not sing Star Spangled Banners or songs before every sports event. I used to, in the 60s when I was fighting the Vietnam War, I was the only one that would sit in Madison Square Garden down. And most of the people that surrounded me had the look of death in their eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, death to me. I'd like to tell you a little bit about a guy named Gino Strada, who ran an organization, I don't know if you've heard of him, Emergency. He built hospitals to treat the war wounded. He has been doing it. He's no longer, it was a heart surgeon who would only build hospitals for war wounded, no matter whose side they were on,
wow.
And mostly children, and a hospital that he would be taking care of. He analyzed war figures, and I think this is a really important fact of war that nobody has realized.
Quick, Bob.
In World War I, 17% civilians. Casualties. World War II, including the Holocaust, 65% civilian casualties. Every war since,
90%.
Civilian casualties. There you go. Bob, thank you for that tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.